For the most part, we are not a people who spend much time in seriousness and gravity. We really don't have to be. We can distract ourselves and can entertain ourselves for much of our lives. But perhaps we don't know the goodness and the necessity of sobriety. The kind of seriousness that hurts. The kind of self-reflection or self-exposure that doesn't flatter you, but tells you the truth, tells you the frank truth. I remember reading Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God by Jonathan Edwards in high school English class. Even though I was a Christian, I remember sort of laughing at the tone of the sermon. It wasn't laughing to mock the sermon at all. It was just the kind of laughter, the sort of nervous chuckle that comes from an unserious person who didn't know what to do with such earnestness on the page. I didn't know what to do with the passion. So my flippancy made that sermon foreign to me and dramatic seeming. Jonathan Edwards' sermon is from Deuteronomy, but the title for that sermon comes from our text today. And it's a text that brings us to that often foreign seriousness. It's a text that confronts us with the judgment of God and why his perfect patience and his long suffering can be turned to wrath. It's a warning from Hebrews, as Hebrews is wont to do. It's a wake-up call and the kind of serious love that shoots an arrow of truth to a congregation, a Christian congregation. An arrow that gets past all the defenses of pride, an arrow that pierces behind flippancy, and it pins down the heart before the cross, and it makes us look, and it makes us respond to Jesus. So why is there a warning about judgment here? All the freight that we've been carrying about the superior priesthood of Jesus, the glories of his work, why stop here to introduce another section on judgment? I want to look at that together. That's our question from this text. And we want to notice three things or highlight for structure three things, and they're this. The judgment comes from those who are sinning deliberately. Those who are, number two, trampling underfoot the Son of God. And this judgment comes to number three, those who ignore the living God. Let me say those again. It comes to those who are sinning deliberately, those who are trampling underfoot the Son of God, and those who are ignoring the right now, current, and always current, living God. Number one. Sinning deliberately after receiving a knowledge of the truth. Look with me again at the text of verse 26. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving a knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Christians sin. That is true. We will carry sin throughout our lives. So we are being sanctified. We have days that are filled with all sorts of disobedience, but sin not like this. The way it's described in the text, where the judgment comes from, is that this is a deliberate sin. This is, in other words, a willingness to sin and a willingness to continue in sin. It's a sign that someone isn't a Christian at all, and therefore, they are not under the mercy of the cross and the forgiveness of Christ's blood. The sacrifice does not apply to them. The recompense that they should expect is judgment, and not a mild one, a very fierce one. A very fierce one. Romans 6, 1 through 2 says, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin? Because as Christians, grace may abound." By no means. We cannot do that. It is unconscionable to think so. How can we who died to sin still live in it? Well, that is, when someone goes on sinning deliberately, they can't do it because they believe that they'll be forgiven. So they persist. They go on. It's the kind of thing where if you are sinning this deliberate way or this willing way, you are either doing it from a sense of licentiousness, an unrestrained embrace of sin that mocks God, that he is not real. It flies in the face. You wave this banner of your own freedom and scorn before him, or it goes in the form of license, like Romans 6 is speaking of, thinking that they can do whatever we please. And ultimately, we know that God has to forgive us. His grace will abound, and so there is no restraint on sin. We just kind of keep on going, presuming upon his mercy and presuming upon his long-suffering and presuming upon the cross. But God will not be mocked. John Piper says that the common way to think of God from an unserious person is that God is to be thanked after a close call and questioned thoroughly after a tragedy. Normally, the posture of a prideful heart. God can be thanked after a close call and questioned after a tragedy, but we don't somberly sit under the work of the cross and think about how it must make us live. Christians are not and cannot be flippant with sin. Someone who is, or someone who begins to calculate that they are free and they can do as they please in anticipation of going back to God later for forgiveness, according to this text, should expect judgment, a fierce one. For them, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. That is, Jesus' death on the cross does not apply to them. They have received the knowledge of the truth, our text tells us this morning. They have heard the gospel. They have seen the Father's love. They have seen the Father's love in the gift of his only Son, and they are rejecting it. The gospel is the good news of the power of God for life and freedom from sin. And it's where perfect love and truth has come to us and served us. It has washed our feet. It has baptized us in the blood of the Son of God. And then, from that person's perspective, that whole situation is just mocked and scorned. As Jesus was mocked and scorned and killed. But he is resurrected and he is victorious. The gospel is to be received, not with money or works, but with faith. It is a gift that is handed out to you. But if it is rejected and it is unwanted and treated with mockery and hardness of heart, then it is not for you. Do you understand that? The gospel is a gift. It cannot be bought, cannot be earned. It is impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, for a man to obtain his salvation, and yet it is handed to you freely from God's love in the gift of the torn flesh of his Son, and that is still rejected and mocked. Sin is still thought of a small thing in light of that. We can still sin in front of the picture of the gospel, and if that's the case, then there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, for the hardened heart in that way. They become, what the text says, God's enemy. You become an adversary to God. In other words, God sets himself up to be entirely merciful to you in every possible way, in every conceivable way. That's the freight of Hebrews that we've been talking about for 10 chapters. It's just the superiority of Christ and the lengths of his salvation and the glory of our high priest. And yet still someone says, I'd rather sin. I don't want your gift. I don't need your gift. And I will sin as I please, and I will do it willingly, and I will do it deliberately. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice cry out among the scoffers. Well, why would you become an enemy of God? So this is where the tension comes, where we are often not forced to be somber, sober in our thinking about God. We rarely think of people being enemies of God. Where and why would someone become an enemy of God? Well, this brings us to point number two. There is judgment expected for those who continue to sin deliberately, but there is judgment for those who trample underfoot the Son of God. Verse 28. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. how much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? This phrase of someone who sets aside the law of Moses here is a bit of a shorthand version, a bit of a phrase for saying someone who has set aside the entire covenant that God made with Moses, setting aside the entire law. So just think for a second, even the first commandment of the law, that you shall have no other gods before you, only Yahweh. So think of someone who takes that and they set it aside, and there was rejection of God, there is a rejection of his laws, there is a rejection of allegiance to him. So that in itself is wicked. But how much worse when they trample underfoot the Son of God? So God so loves this impatient world. God so loves this sinful world. God so has compassion on these people that he, like a mother hen who brings them in under his wing, that he gives his only beloved son, not to condemn the world, but to save the world. But John 3:19 is that light came into the world, but man preferred his darkness. And so there is the giving of the son, and then the heart of man tramples him underfoot. They put a boot on his face. If someone can put a boot on the face of Jesus, this is exactly what you're talking about here. This is like the parable of the wicked tenants. So when the owner of the vineyard, if you remember the story that Jesus tells, he sends his servants, and his servants are treated wickedly, and then he sends his son, but instead of treating the son with the proper respect, they kill the son, thinking, well, now we can just have free reign and do whatever we want. And will not the manager of the fields anger burn hot? Yes, it will. So the narrative thrust of Hebrews over and over again has been this greater insight to the superiority of Jesus brings to us a far greater privilege in our worship. The greater the insight we get of who Jesus is, how he so surpasses all of the old covenant, he just leaves it in the dust, fulfilling all of it. It was all shadow. And he is the substance and all the glory and the riches of his priestly nature, that he sympathizes with our weakness, that in his own flesh he takes on humanity. And then that flesh is torn for us as the veil is torn, giving us full and perfect access before the throne. So think of all of that. And in that greater knowledge, correspondingly, comes greater judgment. The more we see of Christ, the more we glory in how marvelous the provision has been made for sinners, the more you see the cost of the gift that was given to you, the more you see how willingly it is given over to you, the heat is just turned up on what rejection would look like as the mercy of God before you is just ramped up to the highest degree that it could ever be dialed up for you. God could not have given us any more. Literally. He could not have given us more. He couldn't have given us anything better. Our salvation could not be provided for us in any conceivable better possibility than the way it was given to us in Jesus. So it's not just a rejection of the covenant. It's not just a rejection of the commandments. It's a rejection of the blood of the covenant. And whose blood was that? It was Christ. And in a shocking turn of phrase, it says that it outrages the Spirit of grace. That even the Spirit of grace becomes outraged. It's a boot on the face of grace. It's against grace. It's, I don't need your grace, or I don't want your grace. I'd rather have autonomy. Think of that. Grace outrage. But that's what a rejection of the gospel becomes. It's the gift of Christ unwanted. It's the gift of Christ untaken. We have the audacity to think Christ unnecessary. And so we must remind ourselves who this letter is being written to, or who's being spoken about here. And it says that it's those who were sanctified. Now what does that mean? That's an interesting thought for a room full of Christians in a church, presumably. Is it talking about someone who is saved and now is in trouble of not being saved? Because the Hebrews has been talking to us over and over again about the main theme of confidence and going before the throne boldly and having this perfection that we have in Christ and not taking ourselves to the throne insecurely, and nervousness has been sort of cast aside in light of Christ. So now are we being kind of flipped in the script? Are we to not be too secure? Well, no, it's not talking about the security of salvation at all. First, we should know that when someone is saved, they cannot lose their salvation. That is just an impossibility because it is God who does the saving. Listen to how Jesus speaks to us about this very thing in John 6:39. "And this is the will of him who sent me, God's will, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day." So when God saves a man and pulls him to himself and gives him the grace of faith, it is kept and cannot be lost. And yet, what is this context of those who are sanctified? Who are these people who need to heed this warning? We all know from the lips of Jesus, again, the parable of the sower, that there will be those who are among us who hear the word of God and they spring up and it looks like growth, it looks like fruit, it looks like it's bearing the health that everyone else seems to be having, and yet the cares of this world or the deceit of the evil one will kill that seed. It looks like it's growth, but it's not the real thing, and it will not last. And coming into the persecution of the Hebrews at this time, in the flourishing of the gospel, this is precisely what is happening. That it wasn't going to take very much for even a congregation of gathered Christians to have them turn away. And the signs that they needed to heed of that warning was their ability and desire to go on sinning deliberately, to presume upon the grace of God, or even scorn the work that they have been seeing in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Again, 1 John 2:19 describes this dynamic among Christians, one that unfortunately we see the longer that we're in a church somewhere, the longer that you live as a Christian, you see this very dynamic. It said that they went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out that it might become plain that they were not of us. It describes a scenario where people are in the church and yet they do not endure and they do not last. So who is primarily being addressed here? It's people like us. It's people who are in church and among other Christians, and yet it's possible that their relationship to God and their heart in light of the gospel is superficial. They are described as being sanctified. And here in this context, being sanctified means something a little bit like outward conformity. Is that their relationship to the church is that they are sort of conformed to the body and they are gaining some benefits in the body. They have a proximity to the gospel and to the church, and it makes them feel secure. It brings upon their life certain benefits, but it is not real for them. Their relationship to God and faith is not real for them. Think of proximity, think of benefits and things that can bring a sense of comfort that perhaps aren't real. I think of a marriage. Sometimes it's a travesty to see this, but I see it. And you have all the benefits of this kind of covenant relationship around you. You have kids who are laughing down the hall. And you have pictures of vacations and memories that line the mantle and they go down the stairway. And you have meals in the home. And there's shelter, and someone's doing your laundry, and you have all the benefits of the inner workings of a home, but mom and dad do not love each other. You have all the trappings and all these things that you get a certain measure of residual blessing from, but the heart and the core of the covenant is broken. It is not there. And that's precisely kind of where these people were living, that the church brought them a measure of comfort. It brought them a measure of benefit. And as soon as that pressure began to ramp up, the cost was too much. So they would leave Christ behind. And they would trample underfoot the Son of God. It didn't matter how much he had done for them. Sin, abandoning God, became a better option than holding fast, than holding firm. They didn't trust that God would hold them, and they didn't see the cross rightly. The cross became a benefit to them, possibly a status, relieve my guilt, give me a clean conscience, great. But they didn't see God. Faith in our belief, our life as Christian is not intellectual assent, it's heart religion. The grace of God is not to be presumed upon, it is to be loved. The character of God is to be worshipped. Obedience to God should come with joy. We want to find ways. We want to seek ways out to do it more. We pray like the psalmist, search me, God. Know me, God. Reveal any wicked way in me, God. Lead me on the way everlasting. Real faith that's alive hates sin. It does not flirt with it, and it marvels at the gospel. It sits in awe and receives the kingdom, like we talked in Sunday school, like a child. A child has nothing to commend themselves. They just take it. They have to just take it. And Jesus says you must receive the gospel like a child. We need this warning. Sabbath, prayer, giving, missions, apologies, service to others, persecution, hospitality become a joy in the light of Christ. We say, lead me, lead me. We do not trample on the Son of God. We stand in awe of him. And those who wouldn't give it, wouldn't give this awe, wouldn't give heed to this warning because they thought God hard and cruel, that's what God's word is saying. Take heart. If a passage like this is not preached, we miss an incredibly hopeful wake-up call. It's not particularly delightful for a pastor or a counselor or a friend to give these warnings in light of the gospel. And it can at times feel like mercy to shield ourselves from the solemnity of words like this, of becoming an enemy of God for rejecting the gospel. But as the Proverbs say, the mercy of the wicked is cruel. It's cruel not to have an accurate picture of our response before the throne. It's cruel not to call someone and rouse them in counseling or shepherding and in the Christian life to say, brother, I don't know that you're taking seriousness sin in your life. I don't know that you're taking seriously the gravity with which you have been saved. Are you seeing the cross? Is it leading you to joy? Or is it perhaps just leading you to conformity? Is there a benefit that you're gaining, but the slightest little pressure would lead you to walk away? You are in danger of that. And for most of us, you know what is shocking? That pressure is not all that much pressure. And these men were facing persecution. For us, it would not take much pressure at all, I think. If the state of our soul was truly the one that Hebrews is speaking to, it won't take much pressure to want to leave at all. So we need these warnings. There's so many areas in our lives where the hard word isn't said because people are afraid to offend. And that's a worse thing than suffering the humility which comes with a hard word. We said this morning in Sunday school, it's often the hard word that makes for a soft heart. And it's frequently the soft word that makes a hard heart. Jude calls ministers who will not shepherd the flock, who will not guard the gospel, who will not bring this to the attention of their congregants, waterless clouds. They have all the anticipation of feeding and of having the responsibility of looking like being helpful and help me grow. And yet they do not drop any rain for fear of offense. They are waterless clouds, and that is not helpful to us. A third point that we get to, where this judgment comes from. The first was from sinning deliberately. The second is from trampling underfoot the Son of God. But the third is from ignoring the living God. Verse 30 through 31, "For we know him who said, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' and again, 'The Lord will judge his people.' It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God." We must remember that God is not an idol. We don't worship some dead, deaf, mute, dumb, blind block of wood or sculpture in stone. We stand right now before the living God. I want you to just look out the window today at the glory of the world. Look at the sky and the moving clouds and the chirping cicadas. I want you to look up and see stars. I want you to know we're flying around the sun at 86,000 miles an hour. I want you to actually look at the world, that you are being upheld by the living God. Hebrews 1:3, you are being upheld by the word of his power. We're not in a random thing. You know it's real. You know he is upholding you, every breath, every cell, every molecule, every heartbeat. You are being sustained. He is the living God who is holding us. And yet we cannot live as if he is blind and mute and deaf and dumb. He stands and we stand in response to him. Our life is just held in moments, the flicker of an eye. It is so quick. We can look beyond the glory of creation. We can think of just the glory of how he's made our souls. He's knitted eternity on our hearts. He's knitted morality inside of us and the need for a redeemer. And then he has provided that need for a rescue and for health and for reconciliation and for comfort and for glory and for the defeat of evil and the rectitude of all of the reckoning of evil put to death once and for all in Jesus Christ. And then God gave his only beloved son. Not only is it a hopeful thing that God might do this one day, but in light of history, we look back and see that he has done it. He has made all things well. That God did give his son. And that death is put to death. And that Jesus has been raised into victory. He is the living God. And yet, it is flattering to think that we can mock the giving of his son as we navigate through life saying that we do not need him or in rejection of his love. For those who do such a thing, who do not turn in faith to the gospel but hear the gospel and reject it, you stand in judgment and you stand as an enemy of the cross. In fact, right now as he upholds you, his anger burns hot against you. As he upholds you into your next breath, the only thing that is giving you that next breath is his current pleasure of keeping you alive. In Edward's sermon, it's the great illustration of there is nothing keeping you from instantly going to judgment than a spider's web keeping a rock from falling. The only thing that is holding you right now is his pleasure in mercy for you to hear this warning today. And the question comes to us from a text like this. In light of Christ, if you will not give yourself over to faith, if sin needs to be done deliberately and willingly, and if mockery and scorn of the given Son presumes upon you, I would ask you this question: what more would you have him do? So if it is not Christ, where does he fall short? If there's something you want him yet to do for you, name it. Because perfect mercy has been given. And absolute sovereignty has been flexed over the grave and death and hell. And long-suffering patience is with you in this moment and in this one, but maybe not in the next one. So if you hear his voice today, do not harden your heart.